More than 4 in 5 American Indian and Alaska Native women have experienced violence in their lifetime. More than half of this population has experienced sexual violence. And in some counties across the country, Native women face murder rates that are more than 10 times the national average. These are the numbers that show the scope of the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in the United States. But as we've reported on this show, the data are incomplete. Late last year, the Urban Indian Health Institute, which is a division of the Seattle Indian Health Board, found that Salt Lake City ranks among the top 10 cities in the United States where Indigenous women go missing, and Utah ranks among the top 10 states. The Salt Lake Police Department has questioned some of their findings, and you can find their response by visiting our website at thetakeaway.org. But last week, The Takeaway hosted a live event with KUER in Salt Lake City to talk about it. My guests were Jennifer Boyce, campaign chair of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Relatives of Utah, a PANDOS organization. And I was also joined by Representative Angela Romero, a Democrat who represents District 26 in the State House. She's also a minority assistant whip in the House and has made this issue a priority. And my third guest was Graham Lee Brewer, a contributing editor for Tribal Affairs at High Country News and a board member of the Native American Journalists Association. And I began by asking Graham why we're only just beginning to reckon with this problem here in the United States.
Well, it probably depends a little bit on who you ask, but there are quite a few reasons why the data is insufficient. So the federal government does track a lot of this data, but unfortunately, they don't necessarily share it with tribal governments. Tribal governments don't have a lot of access to the data, so it's hard for them to understand the scope of the problem within their own tribal nations. And more importantly, a lot of police departments within the United States don't properly track data. They don't properly track race. And oftentimes when they do, they miscategorize Indigenous women as either white or Hispanic. And so there's not a lot of communication. There's not a lot of data being shared. And so a lot of the gaps in the data are actually being filled by activists and not people in law enforcement. Really, you've seen a lot of the resiliency that defines a lot of Native nations. You're seeing that in this new push to get more data out there. So the Urban Indian Health Institute study that you cited earlier, that's probably the most comprehensive understanding we have of the problem in a lot of those areas. And as that report will state, it's woefully inaccurate because of this huge lack in data. I think when we look at that report in specific, one of the numbers that really jumps out to me is that the oldest case in the report is from 1943, but two-thirds of the cases that are in the report come from 2010 to 2018. That really right there illustrates the scope of the problem, right? That from 1943 to 2010, I can only assume that more than a third of those cases probably occurred. So there's this huge gap, and we are really only just now beginning to scratch the surface level and really understand the scope of the problem.
Representative Romero, I know a lot of people hear about violence against Native women and immediately think of a couple of things. One is that it only happens on tribal lands, and the second is that it only happens within Native communities. Are those myths? And if so, can you help us debunk them?
Those are definitely myths. I represent House District 26, which is the east side and the west side of Salt Lake City, and the Urban Indian Center resides in my district. And even going back to the data, there's a lot of myths that if you're Indigenous here, that you live on the reservation. And as we know, many people, majority actually live in an urban setting, and their perpetrators are not Indigenous.
Jennifer, this came up earlier, but I want to talk about this issue of miscategorization a little bit more in terms of how big a role that miscategorization of Native women plays in the larger problem.
Well, if you think about it, if we're not categorized as who we are, then whenever the numbers are put forth to actually indicate who is missing, who is murdered, and how many, we aren't included in those numbers. And so I think that creates a big issue for us later on down the line because we don't know the scope, and maybe we'll never know the scope. That's honestly how I feel, that maybe we'll never know the entire scope because this has been going on for ages. But going forward, I think that's extremely important to start doing and to start understanding, because if they don't understand us as a people, that's a clear indication that genocide is working.
When you say the genocide was working, you mean you felt erased?
Yeah. No one recognized me for who I am, except for my tribe. my tribes have always recognized me and known. I mean, my Mayan side is really, they're really confused when they see how tall I am, but they still recognize me, you know, as their own, as a catracha in Honduras and as well, but indigenous from there. And so, I mean, how amazing would it be to live in a world where people know your identity and that it's not a bad thing or that it's not something to be ashamed of?
I want to turn a minute to talk about jurisdiction and who has jurisdiction over cases of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. Graham, can you tell us a little bit about if something happens on a tribal land or if it happens right in the middle of Salt Lake City, what is the difference? Who has the jurisdiction there?
Federal prosecutors have jurisdiction typically in tribal lands when it's a felony case. So Congress has placed pretty extreme limits on what tribes can prosecute and what tribal police officers can arrest people for. So it typically falls into, you know, misdemeanors, low-level felonies, because most courts can only give up to a year in prison, I think, and it's like $500 or $5,000 in fines. So federal prosecutors step in, and sometimes this can be a good thing because federal prosecutors come with federal resources. But as Mary Houdetz, a really great Associated Press reporter, reported in October, really, I think it's like 46% of those cases were declined by federal prosecutors for prosecution. So
did they give a reason why?
Most of them were a lack of evidence, is what they said. So I think if you look to Alaska for an example, there are 75, I believe, Alaskan villages that do not have police force. And when you put in the added barrier of weather and having to take like maybe a boat or a plane to a remote region, getting justice can take a long time. So there's programs like Safe Star, for instance, which trains people on the ground to start doing basic examinations and the very beginnings of an investigation for things like a sexual assault, for instance, because those resources might be 2 or 3 days away if they ever come at all. And, you compound that with the idea that many Native people don't trust the police. That NPR did a poll last year that showed that 36% of Native Americans, when they need to call the police, they don't because they fear them. So all of these things add up, and it increases the scope of the problem quite exponentially.
Representative Romero, I want to ask you about jurisdiction, but this time looking at the Violence Against Women Act, which has had various iterations. Where does this stand today in terms of, particularly in terms of domestic violence, non-Native men and Native men?
That's up for discussion again. And I was researching that because majority of my work is at a local level. So when you look at sexual assault, even at a local level, and we're not even addressing Native women, we're addressing all women. We even have the hard conversation of just believing that sexual assault or domestic violence happened. And so then you add on that next layer, and it's even more difficult to prove. And so what we've found with, since we've been talking about sexual violence and domestic violence, I mean, that's what I've based my legislative career on, and I have served in the legislature since 2013. So our whole goal was just to have the conversation that we say start by believing, and we were talking about start by believing before Me Too. For us to even have the conversation about domestic violence and sexual assault and for people to report is already difficult, and then you add on those other barriers, it's not good. But I know recently what was added into VAWA, the Congresswoman from New Mexico wanted to provide victims that are in urban settings to have a victim advocate. And so that's kind of what they're looking forward to pass the House, but we have to see what happens in the Senate.
Jennifer, this is a very personal issue for you. You've had a member of your family members of your family who've been victims of violence, and including a cousin of yours that some people have probably heard in the news, Faith Hedgepath. Are you okay talking about her a little bit and telling us about her story?
Only if you got tissues. Just putting that out there. it never gets easier. I've had 6 family members that are either missing or murdered. Both my grandparents at different times, and I just remember growing up with all of these stories. Because from a young age, you wonder where your grandparents are. You wonder where your family is and why they're not around or what happened to them. I also had my auntie Pablita, which I don't resemble because I'm a mixture of two, several tribes. I don't resemble either my parents very much, but I look just like her. But when she was 26, her husband killed her in Missouri. He was not Native. And then I have my cousins. When I was attending grad school, my younger cousin was attending her sophomore year at UNC Chapel Hill. I believe she was on scholarship. She's extremely, extremely smart, very bright, and she was found raped and murdered in her dorm. And they still have not found her attacker. So what the community back home from, this is from my stepdad's tribe in North Carolina, what they've done is they've created a college scholarship in her honor to give to Native women, young women in the community. In her name, and to remember her and to honor her. And last April, one of my really close cousins was, sorry, I grew up with him my whole life, and he was killed back home in North Carolina as well, from the same Native community. And It was just extremely devastating because I had already gotten into this work because of my grandparents, because of my auntie, because of my cousin. And then to have this happen, it just feels really difficult to keep going. But I'm surrounded by a lot of amazing people that make this work a whole lot easier than it could be. And I also have another cousin, Larissa Lone Hill, who is missing at this time. She's been missing for over 2 years from my tribe in South Dakota. And she just disappeared one day, and they don't know what's happened to her. And that happens every day. This is normal for us.
So many times, particularly in the media, we hear about these things and we intellectualize these issues and we look at them as numbers and percentages. And I want to thank you for putting names and experiences and real faces for this audience to understand that this is a real issue. It's not just a figure. It's not just something that we intellectualize. And I know that was painful, and I appreciate you sharing that with this audience. Thank you very much, Jennifer. To that point, I think this raises the issue of media coverage, or lack thereof, of Native women, Indigenous communities. Graham, I want to pivot back to you for a second. You work with media organizations on this issue. What are they doing wrong? What are they missing? And where can they improve?
I'm going to start where they can improve, and I think the thing I always say the most, when media organizations ask me, how can we do this better? I say, hire Indigenous journalists. Crystal Echohawk did a great study last year. And it found that in national newsrooms, the staff of national newsrooms are 0.36% Native American. At High Country News, we're the only non-Native owned national outlet that has a desk fully devoted to the coverage of Indian country. And almost all of us on the tribal affairs desk are tribal citizens. But there's a lot of misconception, a lot of stereotype, a lot of myth. I think with this topic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in particular, there are a lot of victim and community blaming. I can't tell you how many times I've seen a story about a suicide epidemic in a reservation that is attributed to ghosts or spirits. I would look to marginalization, disenfranchisement, colonization. I would look at those things for the reason why those suicide rates are high, not ghosts or spirits. I also see a lot of things that researchers classify as violent language when we're talking about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Things like Sarah Deer, who is a really great, prolific scholar and writer on this topic. I hear her say this all the time in interviews, that we marginalize these women more and more because we say, well, you know, she shouldn't have been running around with that guy. She shouldn't have been out drinking. She is a drug addict. whatever excuse you want to throw into there, it's an excuse not to properly investigate that. And so we see that furthered and perpetuated by the media coverage. I also think that media, national media in particular, does a really poor job of what we call parachuting into an area of Indian country, and only their only job there is to cover tragedy. That's another thing I always tell media organizations when they ask, how can we do this better? Don't just show up in a tribal community to cover the bad things. So I'm a member of the Cherokee Nation, grew up in Norman, Oklahoma. My Oklahoma history class pretty much started with the land run, right? So at the Native American Journal Association, we all are constantly kind of talking about the fact that we're making up for these gross inadequacies in our public education system. Like you mentioned earlier, less than 30% of Native Americans live on reservations. We're a very urban people. And I think it's important to remember that while historical trauma is a part of our history as Indigenous people, no Indigenous person wants to be defined by that. And so I think when you are seeking out that information, go find writers of color who are putting their thoughts out there, and don't necessarily look to your Native friends to answer all those questions for you, because it's not really their job. It's not incumbent upon Indigenous people to teach you how to not be racist.
That was Graham Lee Brewer, contributing editor for Tribal Affairs at High Country News, Jennifer Boyce, campaign chair of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Relatives of Utah, a PANDOS organization, and Representative Angela Romero, a state lawmaker and Democrat who represents House District 26. And if you want to check out my full conversation with the panel, which includes a Q&A with our audience on the topic, you can visit thetakeaway.org. There's a link to a full video stream of the event. And thanks again to KUER in Salt Lake City for hosting this important conversation.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.